We're going to do a study of 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 today, and I need to work hard, I think, to help all of us see that chapter accurately. And I realize this little silhouette of a scene is not the whole picture, but it's a better part of the picture than what you imagine. The question at hand as you deal with the gospel of Jesus Christ is that how did it turn the world upside down? How did it do it? How did the truth about a God who loves us and pursues us to the end of the earth, who throws out bloody hands that are the penalty of my own sin, but to call me back in to be my shepherd, how did that get to the ends of the earth, and how did it turn the world upside down? And the answer is going to be built around something you're going to hear me say on a regular basis today. I hope I don't say it too redundantly, but I'm going to say it repeatedly. It's the storyteller's story. The storyteller's story turned the world upside down. Oh, I believe in having a place that's nice like this and rows that are set up and where someone can stand and rather didactically teach. I think there's a place for that. There's a place for believers to come and do that. But you need to know that's not what happened at Thessalonica. It didn't happen most of the places. Oh, there's elements that certainly be far more sophisticated than this scene, but it's the power of the storyteller and the power of the story that is true when the storyteller tells it. When I use the word story in English, you don't know what to do with that. Because I can tell the story of a family, or the story of our history, or the story of life, or the story of God. And that word story applies, and you know what I mean. But I could also tell you the story of three little pigs, and I can tell you the story of anything I want to tell you, and the story of Wolf Bill and Turkey Fred, or anything else. And so when I use the word story, you don't have any idea what I mean by that word. It's woven throughout this chapter that what Paul means is what most of the world has meant. When the world told its stories, it told its truth. In fact, that's the normal way. Whenever you sit down with the village elder, when you sit down with someone from the patriarchs of the family, and he told you a story, he told you the truth. And so Paul comes into the city of Thessalonica. He's there 3 weeks. When he leaves, this industrial type city, when he leaves, there's a church there, and they're believers. How come? And the answer, there's the power of a true story in the storyteller's story. There's a guy named Kenneth Bailey who writes, and I think it's worth your time to know who he is, and if you're interested in pursue some of these things. But he says this. He says, we as Americans, we as Westerners, a better way to say that, and we as Westerners, we have a pile of books, and we say, okay, with these pile of books that contain the truth, that we'll take these books and we'll disperse the books, and when we disperse the books, people will come into Christ. And please don't misunderstand me. I'm going to say nothing negative about books. I believe in them, and they're so glad for them. But Kenneth Bailey said that's not what turned the world and is still not turning the world. What turns the world is stories. How Paul would have turned the world upside down is he would have come in and he would have sat around campfires with people at night outside their houses, and he would have sat inside more sophisticated places and sat around tables, but stories. Kenneth Bailey said the rest of the world treasures stories and the way the stories are held. Most of civilized history looks at us at our books, those Westerners, and how we cling to our books. And they say your books are good, but they said, here's the problem. Your books are good. Your minds are weak. I don't know if they could argue with that. Your books are strong. Your minds are weak. Kenneth Bailey said, you could go in, and there were formal settings and informal settings. Kenneth Bailey spent 30 years, over 30 years, with the Bedouins and the peasants in the Middle East. So the Middle Eastern culture and the university students. He said they would sit around a fire like this at night, and when they sit around the fire, the village elders would begin to tell a story, and suddenly everything would quiet. And the story was told with key words, like, I have been entrusted with this story. And other men who were old would nod their head and say, yes, he had been entrusted. And so when he told this trusted story, you knew what he said came from all of his honor. He had no manhood honor if he could not pass on to the story as the story was true and given to him. And the young men, they memorized it. Bailey said you could hear young men who could quote for 2 and 3 and 4 hours at a time, and you could go to the next village and they would quote the exact same words 2 and 3 and 4 hours at a time. They could tell stories that happened 100 years ago that they had not written down in their own language. No one is writing the story down, because why do you need to write it down? Our minds are strong. We tell the stories. Those of you whose minds are weak, you write it in your books. And you could go take in what they had, and you could take it in the English and listen to it 100 years later. And it is the same stuff, same words written down. The telling of the stories. The power of a story. Sometimes, Kenneth Bailey said, in this Middle Eastern culture, and again, trying to give us a feel for how you read the New Testament, don't read it through your Western eyes. You need to read it through the eyes it was written in. He said sometimes they would begin to tell a story and everybody would chip in because everybody knew the story and it was a casual, informal story. But when it came to the entrusted part, he said he was in a town in southern Egypt. And he said, I turned to a man who was in his 60s, and I turned to him and said, "Oh, that's interesting. I don't think I know that story. Would you tell that?" And the man began to tell me the story, and everybody else jumped in and said, "Oh, no, he cannot tell the story. He's not been entrusted with the story." Oh, okay. So the elders who've been entrusted with the story told the story. Kenneth said, I then turned back and said, "How long have you lived in the village?" And the first man said, I've only been here 37 years. But when you passed the story on, you passed on to someone in particular and said, you're entrusted with it. That idea of it being entrusted with the story, you need to know, roots everything about the gospel and how it has spread. In fact, I like many things we have in our Western world. But I don't like that we have lost the power of the story. And we have lost the fact that you are the storyteller. And the power of that story started this church. You do know, don't you, that when you read this about this church in Thessalonica, they had no Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. They had not been written and put in circulation yet. But what they did have is, and I want you to notice in verse 4, if you have your Bible, shame on you, and beat your neighbor if he doesn't. In verse 4, see, we're Western. In chapter 2, verse 4, he uses some language that means specific things. In verse 4, on the contrary, we speak as men approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We're not trying to please men, but God who tests our hearts. This is a storyteller's chapter. I came and I told you the truth. I told you what God has said. I was entrusted with all of my honor as a human being, with all of my dignity of what it worth to be a man. I didn't come with anything false. I came to tell you a story. And Paul would have sat around in scenes like this and told the story. In verse 2, he'll use the word tell. In verse 13, he will talk about a word of hearing. You've been around children. And you've told children stories. You better tell it twice the same way. Did you ever tell a child a story? We made up at our house. We made up it was a sequence for my older kids. Megan had a different set of parents than the first two did. But Wolf Bill and Turkey Fred. And Wolf Bill is obviously the villain in it. And Turkey Fred's the hero in it. And we tell Wolf Bill and Turkey Fred stories. Now I tell the grandchildren Wolf Bill and Turkey Fred stories. But I remember both ways, that when I changed the story slightly, because I didn't remember, did I have him at the circus doing this or that, and when the wolf came and the kids jumped in, and I mean, that's not how you told it last time, and the kids made sure you tell it the same way you told it last time. In fact, when I wanted to make up a different story, don't tell that one. I went to tell Ian a story the other day, and he wouldn't let me change it. It had to go back like it had been before. You see, the mind is an incredible thing to grab stories. And in the cultures that are oral, they could quote for hours and hours the stories that we were entrusted. Paul said, I gave you the story. And the gospel story changed everything. I want to make five basic points this morning. I'm going to call them short points. Who was it? I lost her name. You'll tell me here in a second. But she said, time is relative depending on which side of the bathroom door you're on. So when I tell you, Irma Bombeck, thank you, about 17 of you, see, we know the same stories. We tell the same stories. So when I tell you that I have a short story, you know, a short 5 points this morning, I realize that time is relative. But I want to say five things this morning, just going through this text. The first is this, is that you're a storyteller. You tell the story. If the gospel of Jesus Christ is ever to turn this world upside down again, you're going to have to know who you are. You see, you're somebody entrusted with the gospel. You've got to be a storyteller. Because this trust of all your honor and everything that you know is true is wrapped up in the stories that you tell. There's a series of pictures, word pictures in this chapter that are very important. You hear the word gospel. You have a mindset when you hear the word gospel. I wish you didn't. You tend to sometimes see the little white church down on the corner, and they're having a gospel meeting, and they're going to bring in a preacher, and they're going to have everybody sit in rows, and that wasn't what the word gospel meant. The word gospel meant good news. It just had to do with, hey, I got this neat thing I just heard. This is a wonderful thing I just saw. There's good news. And in fact, literally, it means good newsing is what it means. The idea of passing on this good news. It also has to do with this word in here, or the word preach is used. Oh man, when you hear the word preach, you think of something negative, and I understand that. Guys like myself have brought it on, but that isn't what that word meant. The word preach was the word to herald or proclaim. And when there was something you wanted to go shout on the corner and tell everybody, you went and told it. And when something took place good in your family or good from the king, and I mean, there's any number of applications and threads you can put to this, but it meant to just go tell it. You just told it. It's a storytellers. All those are words. There's a word picture for what God intended for the gospel of Jesus Christ to be preached. And it needs to look to you more like a summer storm rolling across the landscape. It's just a scattering of people who go tell the story, because the story is true, and the story comes out of you being entrusted with everything of your honor. Jesus said, no one can follow me and hear the story that I didn't entrust you to be a storyteller. Jesus said, I made you to be fishers of men, and immediately took these young, very immature men, but he sent them out two by two to go tell the story village to village and town to town. And then he grabbed the 70 and he sends them out two by two. And then at the end of Matthew, he says, look, this is what you're going to do. You're going to all the world and you're going to tell the story. That's what you do. You're storytellers. The idea that somehow the word preach or the word gospel, it lost its organic nature and therefore it lost its impact in the world. When you could relegate it to an institution that's on Newman Road and you can put carpet and praise team and chairs. It's okay to have believers come together and teach a didactic kind of thing, but it's not okay for the people of God to know the story and to lose the storyteller's story in the break rooms and in the locker room. To lose it in a world that doesn't know the truth, and we let other people tell our stories. And we show them on big screens. And we know they're not true, but we don't have any true stories, so we'll let those stories, they're the only ones we know. We'll tell stories that play out in first downs and four quarters. If we have a hole in our chest, would somebody entrusted with the truth just show up in our life and tell stories? But the story that's true, that comes out of integrity. And the absence of that storyteller's story is devastating us. I'm glad we have a Bible college in town, didactic kinds of things for teaching. I'm glad for that. But if you ever, ever think preachers are supposed to come from that college, Bible college across town or south of town, you missed everything. You missed it. When you became a follower of Jesus Christ, you became the storyteller. So are you telling the story? It was the storytellers, those who sat around the fire at night. Jesus, even before his ministry, He would have gone to work by day, and he would have been a carpenter by day, which could have been wood or stone. But in the night, he would have gathered around a fire with the men and the boys, and some of the girls were even allowed in some of the liberal places. And they told the stories, and they were entrusted. And Jesus said, "This is the truth I want you to tell," and storytellers break out. Alan Bimo, who works in Southeast Asia, Alan Bimo said, "You know the most effective way to tell the story of Jesus? You tell stories." I've heard Alan tell the story many times in different ways, and I've even seen it at some level myself. Alan will gather in a village in Southeast Asia, and he will sit down, and people are telling stories. And Alan will say, "I have a story. I love a story." And he'll reach down and he'll grab a stick and he'll draw a diagram in the dirt or something. Or he'll take a piece of my hearing aid. Or he will take a bit of cloth as his object lesson. And he will tell the story of the prodigal son, and he will tell about how that prodigal son is a story that Jesus told because Jesus wanted you to know how God thinks of you. Or he'll tell the story of the sower, and he'll tell the story, and he'll have it diagrammed out, and people crowd in because they want to hear it, and they recognize that he uses language out of their own culture, which is that there's a true story I need to tell you. There's an honorable story I need to tell you. There's a right story I need to tell you. You don't have to worry if I lie to you. A man could have no honor and lie about this. And he tells the story. When he finishes, they'll say to him, "Tell it again." And others in the back of the crowd have come and they said, couldn't hear the story. Would you tell the story again? And others around him will push for it. And he says, No, I won't tell it again. What? He knows how the world lives. Instead, he will turn to the man beside him and say, "I entrust to you the story." And he will hand him the stick. And the man beside him will go, "You entrust me with the story? I entrust you with the story? Yes, you tell the story." And the man will sit and he will say, "Do not let me tell it wrong. I want to have honor." And the man will begin to draw a diagram and he'll tell the story and the villagers will all come and they'll tell the story again. And somebody else will say, "Tell it again." And he will say, "Here, you tell the story." He said the story will be told over and over that night. "You mean there is a God who loves me and who pursues me? And there's a God who will run. Well, what does that do about the evil spirits?" And the story launches into every discussion imaginable. Alan said, somebody will say, "Can I borrow that piece of cloth? Can I have that stick?" He said, "It will come back a week later threadbare, told over and over again." And Alan said, "I am convinced that the story of Jesus Christ, when told, has insurmountable power." You're a storyteller. You're going to get a newspaper next week, our annual College Heights newspaper. In it, you're going to see a little article. You'll want to read it. It's an article that's pretty complex about how hard it is to tell a story. You see, a mother contacted and wrote back, and she basically said this: "My second grade boy went to school. The teacher called me and said, 'I want to tell you something that happened at school.' And the teacher was just so pleased. The teacher said, 'You know, your second grade boy, just in a class, just very casual, just as one friend to another, said, "Hey, I heard a neat story I want to tell you." And the whole class got quiet. And the second grade boy told a story of the blind man and Jesus. And as that dialogue took place, and as a teacher's looking at it, and as you think about it, you realize you and I have been invited to this grand position by great formal training. Would you be a storyteller? You've been entrusted with it. Like a second grade boy enthralled with the truth, would you tell the story? There's a second thing you do. You don't just tell the story. You tell the story because there's incredible power in it. You tell the story because there's incredible power in that story. In verse 13, you're going to see this verse. He's going to say it this way: "And we also thank God continually, because when you received the word of God, which you heard from us, You accepted it not as the word of man, but as it actually is, the word of God, which is at work in you who believe. One of the kindest gifts God gave me was 37 years ago, an episode in my own ministry. And when I say ministry, even there, we have such Western things we impose. I don't mean anything formal. I mean just my own following Christ and just my own trying to be a man who belongs to the Lord. I was volunteering and working with a small little youth group at a church. I was installing bulk gas tanks at All American Truck Lines. That's what I did for income. Hard to believe, but there was a fuel crisis 37 years ago. And so I was installing those in the snow both ways uphill. And in that youth group, there was a young gal who had been there to three Bible studies. Those Bible studies were very informal. We had met just at somebody's house. One of them we had met twice at a set of apartments. And they were just high school kids. And we taught. I mean, I taught. But how much can you teach a girl who knows almost nothing about Christ or nothing about Scripture in a couple of hours? She had a friend. Her friend had a little bit of spiritual interest, but her friend dated a boy who had no spiritual interest. He had no use for any of that. But one day later, after this kind of kicks off, the best friend's boyfriend has an internal crisis where his lies come crashing down on him and his world begins to collide and his emotions are in trouble and he doesn't know what to do because the truth is not in his life and he's in a struggle. And the girlfriend said, "I don't know, but my friend, she knows something." And so they called a friend who had maybe 2 hours worth of Bible teaching of any kind that I'm aware of. And the friend who had 2 hours came over and they spent a couple of hours. And she told everything she knew about the story she knew about Jesus. And they spent most of the night. But I know the next day they came and found me. And so the three of them came and found me and said, "Is this story true? Is what she's saying true? Is this really right?" And so I took more time with them. In fact, I remember sitting on the front porch at a house, because I didn't own the house, and so we just sat on the front porch, and I remember telling more of the story of Jesus. We baptized all three of those before the day was over. Now, you need to know that the boy went home, because he had a brother who was pretty skeptical, and they talked most of the night, and he told the story, and I got to go through a series of sequences, but in 6 days, we had baptized six of those. In 6 days, who the last I knew just a few years ago were all walking faithful with Jesus Christ, or at least the core ones that I knew and still have contact with, walking faithful with Jesus Christ and serving Him. And God took a little girl who didn't know more than a couple of hours of anything, of any story, and she told the story, and it has incredible power. And here's the one thing that you have to match up, and it's just hard to put your finger on. It's not only that the gospel message is true, it's that God also promises to meet you there with it. And it's very telling, He promises to meet. And so the very storytelling becomes a bit of, whether it's the break room or the locker room or wherever it is, the very telling of the story, as one friend tells another, you have this encounter with the living God. There's a third thing you do. You tell the story without error. Verse 3, he's going to say it this way. You tell the story without error. "For the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives, nor are we trying to trick you." When you tell the story, tell it with integrity, he says. Make sure that you tell it with integrity. Now I know that we don't have the same oral traditions, and so we can get more mixed up, and there's a little less public shame by distorting the truth when you tell it. And the mind can start going very fast, and the words lag behind it. I've had Moses build the ark before, and never knew. I had the entire sermon, had Moses building the ark, and you just all kind of nodded your head politely, and you already knew Joan had built it. But anyhow. The integrity issue, though, is this, that when we were ordained and we were made to be entrusted storytellers with all the honor in you, tell it with integrity. It's a funny thing about telling a story with integrity. Normally when we make errors, it isn't errors that just came out of apathy or laziness, so that can happen. When we make errors in telling the story, it almost is always about motive. We made errors because our motives. We make errors because I wanted to be thought of as popular or this or that or this or whatever. And if I really tell the story right, you might not think well of me. And so because of how you think of me, I changed the story slightly to soften it. Or you change the story because there's parts of the story I like. I like how there's a loving God and this is a way you can come to Him. And I like all those kinds of things. But I don't like the fact that God has also said that there is a day of judgment and a day of justice. And God Himself will weep. God Himself, the God who chases you with bloody hands because of His own penalty brought upon Himself. The one, this same God who loves you. When you say, well, I think I want to emphasize this or not that, you lose all integrity. He's going to say in verse 3, verse 5, and verse 6, don't you dare let greed, don't you dare let anything else, any kind of the self-importance of men or yourself change the story. I recognize that cowardliness is the reason many of us might have changed the story. And so he says, you can't do that. The fourth point he's going to say, you tell the story with the love of your own life. And look at verse 8. In verse 8, he's going to say this. He said, we loved you so much that we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of this good news of God, but our own lives as well because you had become so dear to us. I want to make this very, very clear. The story of Jesus Christ has historical and evidential support. The evidence of the truthfulness of the story can clearly be pursued and seen. But it is interesting that Paul says the evidence that I told you the truth in the story is this. It's the evidence that I loved you when I told you the truth. You can't just be a drive-by storyteller. You can't just be somebody who sort of disperses the golden books, so to speak. You can't be somebody who doesn't. You've lost all evidence of the gospel. That if God really changes lives, it is required that the evidence of the story be this, that I really do and really did love you. Here's my life. I give you my life as well as the story. And so that's why an Alan Bimo who comes and lives and tells the story and then lives in the village. And then they work on the water. And then he looks after the outcasts in the villages and the one they chained out at the edge of town that nobody can care for. And when he loves them and they watch, that's when they go, this man gave us our heart. When you tell the story in your circles at your kitchen table, you got to tell it with your own life because that's the evidence people examine first. He uses two illustrations on that. He says, I told you the story like a mother, a tender mother, gentle with you. One of the things that God hardwired into His creation that even in our brokenness we have trouble getting too far away from, and even we're appalled when we see it, is a mother who can't love her children. Even we're shocked when a mother can't love her children. Paul says, the gospel of Jesus Christ caused me to come and to tell the story, and I love you like my children. And we also recognize that in a father, God hardwired, and we're so used to it now, but it's still painful. A father ought to want the best for his children. I want the best for you. I want to raise you. I want you to know the big dreams you can chase. I want you to know the life you can live. He says, I was like that father. I urged you. I cheered you on. I wanted the best for you. I lived with you that way. The best storytellers always are people who tell the story. And they believe that God will meet them in that story. And they tell it with integrity. And they tell it with their own life. They put their whole heart in it. I'm going to ask a pretty frank question. You don't have to answer once. Did you tell the story at all last week? Did you tell the story at all the week before? have you told the story in so long that it's even hard to tell whether you follow the storyteller? There's another thing about the parenting thing I think is worth mentioning. There is no such thing in life as part-time parenting. Oh, there's part-time access due to tragedy and all kinds of things. I understand that, but there are no part-time parents. You can't be a part-time parent. If you're a part-time parent, you're not a parent. That's just the reality. Now, you may have part-time access. That's a whole different issue. But a part-time parent isn't a parent. He uses that parenting illustration to say when you tell the story, you're going to have to go live and love. And you have to put at the core of your life, this is what I'm going to be. I'm going to be a storyteller. I'm going to love people who I tell the story to. That's the option. The fifth thing that he says is you tell the story in spite of opposition. In verses 1 and 2, he says this, "You know, brothers, that our visit to you was not a failure. We had previously suffered and been insulted in Philippi, as you know, but with the help of our God, we dared to tell you his gospel in spite of strong opposition." In verses 14, 15, 16, which we will not go to, he lists out how there were men who followed Paul around and they tried to stand. And he said, "You follow the gospel in spite of that opposition, and we proclaimed it to you in spite of that opposition." Here's just the reality that when you tell the storyteller's story, you too will get the thorns and the nails. And the reason you will is because the storyteller's story that's true, it sets men's lives free, but it shakes up those who prefer to live their lies and love their lies. People who want to live in the darkness, people who want to have their own self-justification, when you tell the true story of the gospel, when you're a herald on behalf and you tell it, you're going to come into conflict. And you're going to have people who speak ill of you, and you're going to find people who think you're out of line. It is part of being this follower. He says in chapter 3 of 1 Thessalonians, he says, "We told you what was going to happen to you, and you have been faithful, and you've stood in front of that test." Part of my question to you is even, what's the quality of your opposition as you've told the story? He'll come on down in verse 18 and tell you, by the way, your opposition is not where you think it is. In verse 18, he says, "We wanted to come to you. Certainly I, Paul, did again and again, but Satan stopped us." He uses something that we tend to toss in the general category of spiritual warfare, but he says Satan stopped us. It's an actual military term. It means to cut the road. Satan cut the road. Well, how do you think Satan cut the road? It's with people. You think your real battle is with that the individual you work with who is so antagonistic to the gospel and takes such shots at you and says such things. Nah, the guy, that assistant manager you're having so much trouble with, just because you live the Christian lifestyle, you need to know that is Satan trying to cut the road with that guy and bless that guy's heart. He's captured too. It's the same thing that Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6, where he says, your battle's really not against flesh and blood, never has been, never will be. It's against powers and principalities, and he goes on to a text. I know this is a pretty simple sermon, but you know, come to think of it, the story of Jesus Christ is a pretty simple story that's turned the world upside down. The only thing it's really lost is not its power, it's lost its storytellers. When you stop telling the story in the front cab of an F-150, when you stop telling the story in break groups, when you begin to formalize it and you somehow institutionalize it and set it off and make it something College Heights or Forest Park or somebody else does, when you lost the fact that you were an entrusted storyteller, when you stopped telling the story, life stopped happening for people. And you even lost what it meant to be a storyteller's follower. I got a letter this week. It's not a very complex letter. It's a very sweet one, though. The letter I got said, "Randy, I know you get all kinds of letters, and most of them have really bad things in them." Said, this isn't one of those. He said, "Randy, life came to my family. To my life. Life came. Life came to me. Life came to my family. Life's come to everything God, Jesus has changed my life. And he talked about the story of Jesus Christ and this incredible truth that is still as true as it was the day Paul walked into Thessalonica, that if somebody just knows the truth about Jesus Christ and will receive it as the Word of God for what it is, God meets you there and you receive life. Is my question, I guess, the same one I had a minute ago. Have you told the story? Are you a storyteller who believes that there's power in that story? If you do, then you're a story follower first, and you're a storyteller second. May God bless you in the telling of the story.